Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in the listen-only mode. Later, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Janitha, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Advances in Treating Chemotherapy-Related Nausea and Vomiting. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration that we have been able to reach so many of you on the call today. We have on the call today over 1,500 participants, so there are 1,500 of you on this call. Very impressive. It's actually the largest number of participants we've had for this particular topic. So clearly you are interested in the topic, very motivated, and we're happy to have you on board. You come from all over the United States. You come from all different regions of this country. And we also have international participants from Australia, Bahrain, Brazil, Canada, India, Italy, Korea, Malaysia, Nigeria, Pakistan, the Philippines, Turkey, Venezuela, and the United Arab Emirates. So you really come from all over the world, and it's a credit to you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. Now, today's program has been made possible with support from Eisai Oncology, and I really want to thank them for their support of the program today. I would like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is an outline that our speakers have prepared, and there also is information about all of the different collaborating organizations, and there is an evaluation form. And we very much value your feedback. Indeed, your feedback helps us to make these programs better and more informative for you. So please take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us what programs you want us to offer? Indeed, the program today is one that you have asked us to offer over and over again. And so your recommendations, really, we try very hard to really make those into programs that you can find useful. Now, we have wonderful speakers today, and I want to start by introducing our first speaker. Our first speaker is Dr. Steven Grunberg. Dr. Grunberg is professor of medicine and pharmacology, University of Vermont, and he's going to cover the following topics. He's going to review of chemotherapy-related nausea and vomiting. He's going to talk about causes and contributing factors and issues of communicating with your healthcare team. Dr. Grunberg?
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be participating in this conference, and we all appreciate the wonderful work that Cancer Care does in organizing these programs. Now, today we're going to be speaking about chemotherapy-related nausea and vomiting. So the first question, of course, is why pick this topic? And the reason is because it's very important to you, to our patients. We know that for the last 30 years, numerous studies have shown that chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting is the side effect of chemotherapy that is of most concern to most of our patients. That's not good that we have to deal with that, but what is good is that the importance of this topic has led to a great deal of research, which has led us to a better understanding of chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting and better methods to treat it. Now, to treat a problem, you first have to understand the problem. So I'd first start out by explaining that nausea and vomiting, although it may seem to be pathologic, may seem to be, well, it is very unpleasant, it does not imply any sort of breakdown of the system or that anything's wrong with your body. As a matter of fact, it implies that your body is reacting correctly. We put strong medications into your body to try to fight cancer. All the body knows is that a strong substance has entered and the body should try to defend itself. It doesn't know we're putting these in for the body's own good, and the body's reaction is to vomit. So this is, although it's not a pleasant reaction, it is a normal reaction. It's almost like a reflex. However, it is not a necessary reaction. Nobody has ever shown that whether you vomit or not has anything to do with whether your chemotherapy is working. I know there are people who would fear to have their nausea and vomiting suppressed, decreased, because they fear that might mean that their chemotherapy won't work as well, and that's not true at all. So we do our best to try to prevent and stop nausea and vomiting because we know that is not going to compromise your care. Now, when you're dealing with chemotherapies, though, we have also found that different amounts of different types of chemotherapy might tend to cause different amounts of vomiting. Some types of chemotherapy, if we didn't give anti-nausea drugs, would cause vomiting in just about everybody they were given to. Some types would cause vomiting in maybe half the people they were given to, and some types of chemotherapy really don't cause vomiting at all. So you don't have to start by assuming that you're definitely going to have this as a problem. You should talk to your doctors and talk to your nurses and find out what to expect. Because there are different levels, different intensities of nausea and vomiting, we have a whole range of different medications that you'll be hearing about, some of which might be good for one level of risk and some of which might be good for another level of risk. It is also important to keep your doctors and nurses informed of what is going on, of whether you're having nausea and vomiting as a problem. As I said, some types of chemotherapy really shouldn't cause any nausea and vomiting at all. And if you're getting that type of chemotherapy and you're having a problem with vomiting, it may be from any one of a dozen other causes rather than the chemotherapy. And your doctor won't know that this is a problem, won't recognize that something else is going on, and won't be able to investigate and perhaps find the cause. It might be a problem with your bowels. It might be an infection. It might be another medication that you're taking. But your doctor will recognize whether your problem, whether the vomiting is appropriate for the chemotherapy or perhaps is more or less than would be expected, and then can react appropriately, can investigate, and can improve the medications that you're receiving, change them, or treat the other cause, whatever that might be. When we look at nausea and vomiting, we also divide it down into several categories. We call one acute vomiting, vomiting within 24 hours after chemotherapy. If your chemotherapy is going to cause vomiting, that's the most common type. There's delayed vomiting, vomiting that might appear a couple of days later. Well, that only comes with some types of chemotherapy, and as it turns out, requires different types of medication. So your physician has to know, and they'll only know from you, what happened and when it happened and what worked and what didn't. There's even another type called anticipatory or learned vomiting. It's just an association. For example, if you have had a bad experience one time at the hospital, you may start feeling sick to your stomach just seeing the hospital again, hours before you get your chemotherapy. That takes totally different remedies. And, of course, the best way to prevent that one is to not have the bad experience, not have the vomiting in the first place. And that's why we try to tell people, don't wait until you're sick to ask for medications for nausea and vomiting. It's much easier and much more effective to prevent nausea and vomiting than it is to try to stop it after it's already begun to happen. Now, what type of chemotherapy you're getting is the most important factor in determining whether you're at a high risk or a low risk of chemotherapy-related vomiting and what anti-vomiting medications you will need. But we know there are other factors that help us to predict what's going on and to design better treatments for you. We know, for example, that younger patients have more of a tendency to vomit than older patients, even given the same chemotherapy. So we can watch out for that and adjust our treatments appropriately. We know, actually, that women have a greater chance of vomiting with a given chemotherapy than men. We can take that into consideration. We know that people who have had a history of morning sickness with pregnancies or motion sickness, air sickness, or seasickness are going to be more likely to have chemotherapy-related vomiting when they receive such chemotherapies. So if you can tell us a little about yourself, I mean, obviously we can see how old you are, but if you can tell us whether you tend to get motion sickness, that can help your doctors and your nurses to design better treatments for you. We actually also know that people who have been heavy users of alcohol actually have less of a tendency to vomit. Now, this is not talking about the alcohol that you would, something you would take on the day of treatment. We're not telling people to go out and have a few drinks on the way to the hospital. That would be a very bad idea indeed. But if we do know, your doctors will ask you, do you smoke? Do you drink? And this information all helps us to come up with better treatments for you. Now, these days, everybody's hearing about personalized medicine, about designing a targeted therapy that's just right for that individual. This is still really, in many areas, in its early stages, and that includes our area on nausea and vomiting, but we are making progress even in this area. We know, for example, that we can detect differences in the enzymes in your body that control how your body handles an anti-nausea drug, how long it stays in the system. And we are starting to get to the point where we could predict that one person might need a little more medication or a little less medication to get the same effect. We know that even on the neural pathways that control vomiting, there are differences, and some people may be more sensitive than other people, and we may be able to predict that. And there's starting to be a thought, well, we know that people who are more closely related are going to have genetic patterns that are more similar, and it may turn out that as we go to different countries or different races, just the gene patterns that different groups carry may affect which anti-nausea drugs are going to work better or how likely it is that people are going to vomit. And as we understand this better, we will be able to design better treatments for all of the individuals. Now, what I've been talking about here is the science, the kinds of things we would measure by taking a tube of blood. But the best way of learning about you for us is to talk to you. And communication between you and your doctor and your nurse is perhaps the most important part of improving anti-nausea care. We did a study a number of years ago where we asked doctors and nurses how much they believed patients in their practices were having vomiting after chemotherapy, and then we asked patients in the practices. What we found was that the doctors and nurses, and these were people who were very aware of this problem, were very good at telling us what was happening to their patients on the day of chemotherapy, but tended to underestimate what might be happening 2 or 3 days later. Because by that time you're home, you're away from the hospital, you're away from the office, there's no way for us to know about it unless you tell us, and there's no way for us to improve the treatment plan unless we know that a problem is there. We recently did a study with a group in Chicago that looks at patient perceptions, and we looked at the kinds of questions, the kinds of ideas that might be interfering with doctors and patients communicating and getting the best anti-nausea treatment. One thing we found, of course, is that patients don't want to take any more medications than they have to. Doctors don't want to give any more than they have to, but we've got to be careful that this doesn't lead to us under-treating nausea and vomiting. We found out, you know, one thing we did note was that many patients want to appear strong. You really don't want to be much of a complainer, while many doctors think that their patients are telling them everything that's going on. So if the doctor thinks they're hearing what's going on and you're not telling them, we're not going to know. We can't change it. We also found that there are still a significant number of doctors and patients who believe that whether you're having vomiting or not relates to whether your chemotherapy is working. And as I've said before, that's not true for any of us. Doctors also, your doctors care about you. And I will tell you about one other study where we tried to figure out how to educate doctors to do a better job on giving anti-nausea medications. We tried, in this one hospital, they tried telling the doctors and nurses about best practice. That did not have that much of an effect. They had lectures. That did not have that much of an effect. What they then did was to make sure that the doctors were hearing what was happening to their own patients. And what they found was that the doctors and nurses reacted immediately, as soon as they knew what was going on with their patients. So the communication between you and your healthcare team is probably the most important single thing that you can do to help us to do the best job for you. And now in terms of the things that we can do, I will pass on to the next speaker.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Grunberg, for being so informative and very comprehensive, and I know there will be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Mark Criss. Dr. Criss is Chief Thoracic Oncology Service, the William and Joy Ruane Chair in Thoracic Oncology, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, and he's also Professor of Medicine Weill Medical College of Cornell University. Dr. Criss is going to address advances in managing nausea and vomiting, how clinical trials contribute to your treatment options, and how to maximize your quality of life during treatment. Dr. Criss?
Thank you. Thanks, Carolyn. I, too, appreciate the chance to speak to so many of you today, and it's just a testimony to what Steve just said, that this is such a critical problem to people facing cancer treatment that three times the usual number that take part in one of these phone calls are here today. Again, it's just that important. I just want to share what Steve said, and I think the real message there is that this is a problem that can be managed and it can be prevented. And we've made tremendous strides in being able to give treatments to every patient that can lessen the problem. We can prevent vomiting in the vast majority of patients. substantially lessen the nausea. And the fear that many people have when they begin cancer treatment is one that is in many ways unjustified, because we can help you. We need your help to do the job, and all members of the healthcare team have to work together to do things right, but you can definitely be helped here. The way that physicians and nurses approach this problem is they know what cancer treatment is planned for you, either a particular kind of chemotherapy, a particular number of chemotherapy drugs, dosages of chemotherapy, and sometimes chemotherapy given with radiation or sometimes radiation alone. And the way we decide what's the best anti-emetic treatment, anti-nausea treatment, is that we match a program of anti-nausea medicines to the specific chemotherapy program that your team has outlined for you. And it's simply that clear and easy. What has happened is many professional organizations, the American Society of Clinical Oncology, the Medical Oncology Society, the Oncology Nursing Society, ONS, MASC, the Multinational Supportive Care Group, and the National Cancer Center Network have all made guidelines, which are available on the Internet, available in publications, where your healthcare team, pharmacists, nurses, physicians, can have the best anti-nausea treatments for the various types of chemotherapy that are available. What you need to do is to make sure that you are prepared when you're ready to start your chemotherapy, that the medicines you need to take are either prescribed for you, if they're going to be given to you by the healthcare team, or if you need to fill prescriptions from a local pharmacy and bring them with you, that you make sure that that's been taken care of, so you're all ready to go when the chemotherapy or radiation is about to be prescribed. I think a couple of other issues is that risk of nausea and throwing up after chemotherapy or radiation for many of the chemotherapy drugs is not something only on the day of chemotherapy. It is something that can happen many days after. And actually, for a strong drug like cisplatin, the most common day now for people to have problems is 2 days later. So you may have had excellent control of nausea and vomiting on the day of chemotherapy and the day after. And you may say to yourself on the third day, why should I take this medicine? I got this fact information that there's a lot of side effects. Why should I take the risk when I'm doing just fine? But the truth is, it is very important that you take your medicine each and every day it's prescribed, no matter how well you feel. And unless you're having a side effect, and that too needs to be brought to the attention of your healthcare team, please take the medicines each and every day that they've been prescribed to you, and whether or not you feel well on that day. Now, all these different guidelines that I mentioned boil radiation and chemotherapy into four different categories. Those with the highest risk of emesis, a moderate risk of emesis, a low risk of emesis, and a minimal risk. And just to second what Steve said before, probably the vast majority of cancer drugs have no risk of emesis or a minimal one, and you don't even need any kind of anti-nausea medicine or anti-nausea medicine prevention. And just to remind you of that, and that's the so-called minimal risk category. So for three of the four categories, the high, the moderate, and the low, the standard treatment is a drug called dexamethasone. It's a steroid medication, a cortisone-type drug available in intravenous and pill form. And it's taken from 1 to 3 days. So for the low-risk patients, those drugs are not low-risk patients, but low-risk anti-emetic treatments, you would only need to take it 1 day. For the moderate risk, usually 1 day. And for the high risk, you would need to take it for up to 4 days. In addition to that, for the high moderate risk, we routinely recommend another class of drugs, something called 5-HT3 antagonists. Serotonin antagonist is another name. And there's four of these drugs on the market, a drug called palonosetron, a drug called dolazetron, a drug called granisetron, and a drug called ondansetron. All of these have their trade names as well. Palonosetron is Aloxi. Dolazitron is Enzamet, Granicitron is Kytrel, and Ondansetron is Zofran. Each of these drugs has been shown to be extraordinarily safe, very effective, and there have been large clinical trials that have been undertaken to compare these drugs. And those clinical trials have by and large shown that the drug palonosetron is somewhat better than some of the alternatives. So if you have the choice to use any of those agents, palonosetron is the drug. Now, unfortunately, we do not have an oral form of palonosetron widely available here in the United States. So in situations where you'd need an oral by-mouth medicine, you'd have to use something different. But palonosetron is the drug of choice there. The last drug is a drug called aprepitant. It's a so-called NK1, neurokinin 1 receptor antagonist. Aprepitant also is an oral medicine, pill form. There's an intravenous form of it called fosaprepitant. This drug has been shown when added to the 5-HT3 drugs like palonosetron, when added to the drug dexamethasone, to further improve the prevention of emesis over the two drugs alone. So we generally recommend a three-drug combination for any of the chemotherapies that are strong, things like cisplatin, or any of the very strong chemotherapy combinations like the doxorubicin and cyclophosphamide. So the standard of care for the high and moderate risk regimens of radiation or chemotherapy is three medicines, dexamethasone, usually given for 3 days, aprepitant, given for 3 days, or the single intravenous dose on the first day, and palonosetron, generally given on 1 day before chemotherapy. We don't know exactly when you have to take it in relation to your chemotherapy, but again, the idea is prevention. So it makes the most sense for us to recommend the medicine to you before you start your chemotherapy. But if you forget and take it 10 minutes after you got it, it should be no problem at all. There usually is time for the drug to be absorbed, even when it's taken by mouth. So just to reassure you, these drugs are widely available throughout the whole world. They're in virtually every pharmacy, hospital pharmacy, physician's office. We have these guidelines that tell your doctors, nurses, and pharmacists how to give the drugs, and it's more to let you know the thinking process behind it, to know the medicines you're going to be prescribed, and to ask your help in making sure that when a drug is prescribed to you that has to be taken by mouth, particularly either before you come to the hospital over the next days, that you take it. I've been asked briefly to speak about two other topics, and I think they're very important ones and worth a few moments of our time here. One of them is the whole issue of clinical trials. It's something I think is important for every person with cancer. And I think for you, the main thing about clinical trials is that it can provide you with an additional treatment option. So no matter what stage of illness, what kind of cancer, there is usually a clinical trial available. And if your healthcare team does not offer you participation in a clinical trial, you might want to ask them, is one available for you? While there can be a trial for any aspect of illness, any stage, any type, they don't necessarily have one for every one currently anywhere in the country or at the healthcare setting where you're being treated. But I think it's always a good idea to ask. There are different kinds of clinical trials. Probably the largest ones and the one that people are most likely to be asked to participate in is what they call a phase two trial, and that's where they have already done some preliminary testing of a medicine, and they want to know if that medicine works for your specific problem, be it nausea or your specific type of cancer. That's called a phase two trial, and the goal of that trial is to see just how good that medicine is. There are two other kinds of trials done. One is called phase one. Phase one are generally the first trials done in people with cancer. And they're the trials where the doctors try to figure out what's the best dosage of the medicine, what's a safe dose, and what are the spectrum of side effects that can happen. We also look whether or not it's effective in fighting cancer or the cancer-caused problem, but that's a secondary goal. It's mainly to figure out how best to give the medicine and what's the right dose. There's a third kind of trial called phase three, where the new medicine is compared to a standard of care, And there, there's a procedure called randomization, where literally a coin is flipped, and people that choose to be part of the trial either receive a standard treatment or they receive a new experimental treatment. One word of advice is that those of you that may have looked into this already know that figuring out whether or not a clinical trial is right for you is really hard. And that's just a fact. And I would summarize it saying that you almost always need some expert help in doing this. When you see the entry criteria for clinical trials, it's a specific stage of disease. It may be a specific subtype of cancer. It may be a certain number of prior kinds of treatment. It may mean that you need a certain level of blood test that would allow you to safely receive the medicine. And there are questions that a regular person just can't answer on their own. You need your healthcare team to help guide you and navigate. So please, don't be afraid to ask. I think the next question after you say, is there a clinical trial for me, your doctor and nurse has to help you figure out if a particular trial is going to be safe or the right thing for you. And you really need some professional help in doing that. It's a complicated issue, deciding whether to take an experimental treatment or a standard one. I urge you, in addition to discussing it with your healthcare team, make sure you discuss it with your home team, the people you turn to for advice on how to fight your cancer. I encourage you to think about who's on that team and to constantly work with them and bring them up to speed about your care, but you need their help too and advice. And just a reminder is that the choice is ultimately yours. It first and foremost has to make sense to you. In truth, it's not a medical decision. In essence, all these clinical trials are equal. They're testing something new. They've gone through safety reviews by institutional review boards and the hospitals. The government and the National Cancer Institute or the Food and Drug Administration has reviewed them. So they're all new approaches to cancer, but it has to make sense to you. Make sure that you don't enter any kind of a clinical trial until you are personally comfortable with it, you've had all your questions answered, and you and your team together agree that it's the right thing for you. And lastly, just to say a couple words on communication. I think Steve hit the nail on the head there. We need to listen to you, and we need to hear you. And just a few words to help improve communication. Number one, please remember that I'll speak for the physician types. We're very human. We're not perfect listeners, sometimes things need to be repeated. The second thing is plan ahead. When you're having a physician visit, think about what you want accomplished that day, what you want to learn from your healthcare team, what questions are important to you. Also, don't take on all that responsibility by yourself. Use your healthcare team to help you ask questions, help you remember the questions, and help you think through what's important. And I'd urge you to think about the rule of three. Most people can generally follow through on three things. It's no coincidence that there's so many things that are three in our societies. And if you would think about when you come to see your healthcare team for your visit, the three things that are most important to you, make sure your team knows what those three are. Make sure you ask those questions and don't leave the visit before you get the answers that you need to get you through the next few weeks. And with that, I'll finish. And again, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you today.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Chris, for just an excellent presentation. And that rule of three is really wonderful. Everyone needs to remember that. And much of what you said is really terrific and very helpful. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Linda Pataki. Linda is a clinical nutrition specialist, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Linda is going to address nutritional concerns and tips. Linda?
Hi, Carolyn. Thank you so much for including me in this panel, and I am so thrilled that so many people are tuning in to listen because, like Dr. Chris said, the best teams are the multidisciplinary teams, the doctor, the nurse, the dietitian, and most importantly, you, the patient. And I want think this is a wonderful topic because nausea during treatment can lead to so many different side effects, such as food aversions, which is where people are afraid to eat because they might throw up, or even just thinking about food makes them nauseated, which can lead to dehydration and electrolyte problems, constipation, muscle loss, and malnutrition. And so I want to address some little tips and techniques that people can implement themselves to work in combination with their anti-emetic or nausea medicine treatment to help reduce the risk of feeling bad as well as eating badly. Something that's real important is keeping your portion small and eating frequently, not overextending the stomach, but every 2 to 3 hours trying to eat something, which often tends to be tedious when you're eating 6 times a day. But if you want to just eat small amounts, then to meet your nutritional needs, you really have to eat more frequently. A lot of people are very tense when they eat, and that ruins the satisfaction of meals. So I encourage people to make sure that mealtime is a relaxing time and they chew their food well and they try and do it with other people so it's more social and relaxed. Snacks tend to be, people tend to do better with dry snacks such as crackers or toast or breadsticks, and these are also things that are easy to carry around with you whether you're at home, out doing things, or walking from appointment to appointment at the hospital, as many people have to do while they're undergoing treatment. I do discourage people from eating their favorite foods when they are nauseated, because then they tend to associate those foods with nausea, and rather save those for those times when they are less nauseated. Greasy foods tend to stay in the stomach longer. It takes longer for them to empty out. And the longer that that food sits in the stomach, the more likely it is to cause nausea. So I tend to encourage people to eat lighter foods, not anything that's deep fried, anything that's too spicy, which could increase stomach acid secretion. And a lot of people are sensitive to food aroma. Cold foods tend to have less food aroma than hot foods, so maybe during those very nauseated times tend to stick to colder foods and then eat the warm foods when you're not as nauseated. If it's something that's in a cup, put a lid on it so that the aroma of the food isn't constantly hitting you in the face. And when you're eating, try and eat in a well-ventilated room. I tell my patients they need to stay out of the kitchen. That makes them very happy if someone else is doing the cooking for them, so that they're not smelling that food constantly, because that can be a turnoff. Sucking on candies can help. Tart tends to work on people better than sweet, so things like lemon drops or ginger candies tend to work well. Mint may or may not work well. Mint has two sides. It could be an irritant, but it can also make your mouth feel fresher. So that's something that you'll have to experiment with on your own. The other thing that I wanted to address is fluids and hydration. When people are nauseated, they tend not to drink as much, and I actually do tell people that they should drink between meals rather than at meals, again, so they're not over-distending their stomach at mealtime. But it can be very hard to meet fluid needs. Little rule of thumb, for every 20 pounds of weight, you need at least one cup of liquid, and that can go up significantly, especially if you are vomiting or you have diarrhea or if you have constipation. So That's your baseline for fluid intake. And that fluid doesn't have to be water. Sometimes water is nauseating in itself. It can be soups. It can be Jell-O, popsicles, teas, especially ginger teas or mint teas. Ice chips are all good sources of fluid intake. And I encourage people to try and meet those fluid needs, not just to meet their hydration, but to prevent other side effects. As I mentioned earlier, if the aroma of what you're eating or drinking bothers you, then put a lid on it and rather take it through a straw. You can even do that with soups. I touched earlier on ginger. Sometimes ginger is very effective in relieving nausea for patients. And so things like ginger tea, ginger ale, or cooking with ginger may be effective. A lot of patients like to lie down after their meals because they're fatigued, and that's very understandable. But I do recommend, to prevent refluxing, that you keep your head elevated at least 30 degrees. For 30 to 60 minutes after the meal, either lay in a recliner or prop yourself up if you're going to lay in bed. And then try and associate eating with pleasant activities, such as spending time with family, surrounding yourself in a pleasant environment. Maybe that means eating outside on the porch or eating in the living room. But the more positive associations you have with eating and drinking, the less impact the nausea will have on you. So I thank you again, and I look forward to your questions. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Linda, for really all the tips and suggestions to help people from a nutritional perspective. So thank you very much, and there will be questions, I think, for you as well. We now have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. Now, there are a lot of people on the call, so if we do not get to your question, Cancer Care is always here, and you can call us at 1-800-813-HOPE, and that number is in all of your materials. So we'll take as many questions as we can, but because of the large number, we definitely will have many of you calling us after the call. I'm going to ask Trinitha to bring all of our speakers on board, and would you please invite the audience, let them know how to ask questions.
Thank you. Trinitha? Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then one, on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered, or if you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Our first question is from Teresa Kay. Your question, please.
Ask about when you use Zofran with somebody getting cisplatin, is there advantage over PO versus IV? And should you automatically, I know a lot of physicians write it PRN, would it be better to just assume that you should always give it?
Good question. Thank you, Teresa. And Dr. Chris, would you address that question?
Sure. The research community has done a lot of comparisons by oral or intravenous, and they are absolutely identical. Now, the dosages can change, so the dose of an intravenous anti-nausea medicine and the oral equivalent might be different, but the effectiveness is exactly the same. So, and obviously the oral is so much more convenient whether you're in the hospital or not. So both are just as powerful and just as effective. I'm sorry, there was a second question there that I – a second part
I
of that question. Oh, yeah, whether or not to take it as needed. Now, there's two issues here. The first is the prevention dose. In there, you have to take it absolutely beforehand. But ondansetron, Zofran, is also used – for people that have nausea despite having the preventative anti-nausea medicine. And generally in that situation, it's best to take it only if you need it.
Just to add on to the question of intravenous versus oral, there are actually a lot of different ways these medications can be given, which have been equally effective. If somebody has trouble swallowing pills, for example, Zofran also comes as a liquid. and different type members of this family may come as a little tablet that dissolves on your tongue or even as a skin patch. So there, and all of these seem to work.
Excellent. Very helpful tip. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Frank S. Your question, please.
Oh, yeah, I have thyroid cancer with lung metastasis, and they're talking about doing oral chemo. Is that pretty much the same result? You know, would you get the same? I haven't spoken to the endocrine people yet about it, but would you pretty much get the same results of, you know, the problems you get from doing the regular chemo, or is oral chemo a little different?
Well, that's an excellent question. Dr. Gronberg, would you just talk a little bit about, could you answer that in a general way in terms of oral medications?
Sure. On the whole, if a medication is one that causes a good amount of vomiting given intravenously, it's going to do something very similar orally. One thing to remember, though, is that where chemotherapies intravenously are often given as one or only a few doses on each month or each cycle, oral medications may be given at lower doses for much longer periods of time, sometimes 7 or 14 days in a row. So you may have, with the oral medication, you may find that you have less problem in the early days, but you still want to keep taking whatever anti-nausea medicines have been prescribed because the problem may actually build up as you reach the end of an extended course of treatment. So that's something a little different to watch out for on the orals.
Okay, thank you.
I might just also throw in that in general, the oral chemotherapies are less nausea-provoking, though there are some differences, as Dr. Grunberg pointed out. So, I mean, that's one of the real pushes to the oral chemotherapies is that they do have less nausea associated with them. So I'd be very hopeful as you go forward that you'll be able to take your medication without a problem.
Your next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Angel H. Your question, please.
Yes, I have a lot of patients. They're having nausea, vomiting, and it just we couldn't find any reason. The patient is out of the chemo for a while, and it's definitely not from the chemo. It's definitely not from the pain medication. All the medication they've been using for a long time. One of my patients start to have a nausea, vomiting. On the day after she received the chemo, and it just seems like the nausea vomiting never really goes away. Can you recommend what should we do here?
That's an excellent question, Angela. I'm going to ask Dr. Grunberg and Dr. Chris to weigh in on this one, and I'm going to ask them to actually do it in a general way, to just talk about this as a general issue, and also the concept of differential diagnosis. How do you decide what's going on, and how do people understand what then best to do?
Well, this can be a very, very difficult problem when you see a patient having the situation you describe. You should remember that if a chemotherapy is being given on one day, the nausea and vomiting from that chemotherapy, for most people, will not go on for more than a week, even if they're having it fairly badly. So if you get beyond a week, you do have to wonder if anything else is going on. Once again, sometimes you will never find the cause. But you must also think about whether their bowels are working, and that can be a matter of a bowel blockage for a patient with colon cancer, or it can just be a matter of severe constipation. You will need to make sure that their body chemicals have remained in balance. High levels of calcium, for example, can cause vomiting, as can kidney problems. You've already mentioned looking at their other medications, and sometimes, as we pointed out, a person just gets so used to the idea that they're going to be sick that they're sick. And if that's the case, if it's almost like a learned cyclical reaction, sometimes I'll find that an anti-anxiety medication may actually be good just to break that cycle. So that's something else you can try. Another thing to remember, as was pointed out when we were talking about diet, is that chemotherapy itself can change the way that foods taste. And you may have somebody who gets in a situation where everything just tastes bad. And that's what's making them feel somewhat nauseous. And then the kinds of tricks such as the lemon drops and the ginger drops just to hide the bad flavors may be helpful as well.
Just to emphasize, too, the need to have your healthcare team think through all the possible causes of nausea and vomiting in somebody with cancer. And that the list, as Steve pointed out, is quite long. and Linda as well. But you need to think that through. A couple other issues. The I can't emphasize enough the need for potent anti-anxiety medications. They have been shown to be important adjuncts, things like alprazolam or Xanax or lorazepam, Ativan. Those have been shown to be very important adjuncts to antiemetic therapies, even in the preventive setting. When they've looked at the amount of anxiousness in people facing chemotherapy, it's very high. I guess that goes without saying. And these medicines are very helpful. And many persons facing nausea in those situations get great benefit from those medicines. The second issue is many people receiving cancer therapies and with cancer have peptic ulcer symptoms. The chemo radiation seems to kick up, you know, a tendency toward ulcer or heartburn, and many people do better taking a drug like omeprazole, proton pump inhibitor, or an H2 antagonist like cimetidine along with that. And again, more importantly, to try these various initiatives and think and then rethink it, too, if you don't figure it out the first time. Because it's really a difficult problem and really degrades the decency of the life of people trying to fight cancer.
I'd like to weigh in on this one also with regard to getting a detailed diet history and finding out when the nausea is occurring. It might be food aversions. Sometimes patients are not very active and they have motility issues in their bowels. Things aren't moving along, and something just like taking a walk after meals can help with nausea. Identifying any food aversions that they have and help them work through those things. Sometimes getting a little fiber in the diet and getting the bowels moving can also help.
Thank you. And here you have the whole multidisciplinary team in action trying to help with, and it's really important to work with your whole team, I think, as all of our speakers have said, in trying to, you know, address this issue. So I hope that's helpful to you, Angel, and thank you. Our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Teresa S. Your question, please.
Yes, I'm wondering if any of you are prescribing ginger capsules for use in controlling nausea.
Question? Dr. Chris?
The answer is, as it turns out, I seldom have to prescribe it. People seem to have found their way to it even before I think of it. I think many of you have read about the usefulness of ginger. I think people from personal experience know that many times taking a ginger containing food does lessen nausea and takes away some of the queasiness of the stomach. So I personally let and encourage people to use it whenever they think it's helpful. The one thing, though, I would ask you to remember, though, that ginger is an adjunct. Just like a few minutes ago I talked about adding in alprazolam or lorazepam, it's an adjunct to the other maneuvers that we have. It's not a substitute. So if for those people where medicines were prescribed but weren't effective enough, and then I think ginger is an alternative. The problem that docs have is, you know, there's not like a pill that we can prescribe, or we can't send you to the pharmacist with a prescription. It doesn't, unfortunately, work like that. But whatever ginger product you find that you find works for you, I think is perfectly fine. Steve, do you advise your patients in a different way?
And again, just to add in on this, we've actually had a great deal of interest in ginger, and I spent quite a bit of time talking about it with Dr. Casseleth from Sloan Kettering. Ginger has a huge, very long history in folk medicine. Actually, even in the English literature, you can find references as long as 400 years back about the powers of ginger. The thing is, the scientific experiments, the results when people have tried to look at it, and there have been several large studies in recent years, have been rather mixed. There was one study done in upstate New York that suggested that there was some anti-nausea effect, and then another study done in Michigan that suggested that there wasn't. So we're really not sure exactly how much is there. I put this in the general category of remedies that couldn't possibly hurt. I mean, I know that my mother and my grandmother were giving me ginger ale for a sick stomach ever since I was a little kid. And it seemed to work. I have no objection to it. You probably can get ginger, you know, ginger capsules in the health food store. I doubt whether they would hurt anything. They might help. I have no objection, and I think, like I say, that we really need to look more carefully into some of these natural remedies that have been around for a long time. If they've been around for a long time, there might be a reason why they, why people still use them.
Excellent. And Linda, do you want to add anything?
There is no adverse effect on the ginger capsules, but because they're not regulated, their dosing is not necessarily consistent, so you're gonna get variance in how effective it is. But in terms of a naturalist way of incorporating ginger into the diet, for example, ginger teas, or I think it's very acceptable. There's no contraindication, and it can definitely be beneficial. There is on the market ginger candies and ginger lollipops. However, for some people, I know, for example, I work with esophagectomy patients, sometimes very sugary foods can cause other intestinal problems. So if the candies and the pops, the lollipops are something that are convenient for you moving around, then go with the candies as long as it doesn't have any side effects. And then if not, then go with the teas.
I would say up here in the Northeast, we can get ginger apple cider. And although I've tried it, I must say it is not the best tasting drink that I've ever had. But I would say if you do use ginger ale or ginger tea, you know, the original quote on ginger was it soothes the stomach. And at the same time, you avoid the dehydration that Linda was mentioning as a danger.
If, just to throw one thing in there, too, with all, you know, supplements and additional complementary medications, please listen to your body on that. If the medicine is helping you, by all means, it's safe, and I think you've heard from all of us that it's very reasonable to try ginger. Conversely, if it does not agree with you, just like with any medicine, do not persist in taking it. You know, talk to your healthcare team, but don't take something that is not agreeing with you.
And I would also say, even if it is agreeing with you, if you're taking a large amount of something, let your healthcare team know. I don't know of any dangers or interactions with ginger, but there are some other herbal remedies that actually do interact with chemotherapy, some for the better, some for the worse, and your doctors and nurses need to know that to give you the appropriate doses.
Excellent. Well, I have to say this has been an outstanding, really an extraordinary conference call today. I want to thank all of our speakers. You've been just remarkable. I want to thank all of you who've asked such wonderful questions. I know that in asking the questions, you're hoping to get an answer for yourself, but in asking your question, you also end up helping everybody on the call. Everyone benefits from the opportunity for all of our speakers to address your question. And I want to thank all of you who've been listening. I want to, before we conclude the call, I want to take a moment and just review the many services that you can access from Cancer Care. Although this particular workshop will end shortly, all the services, all the free services that you can access from Cancer Care, those continue endlessly, and I just want to remind you what those are. Now, we have a staff of 50 master's-level trained oncology social workers. And we are here to provide a host of services to each of you, and as you need them. We offer just the chance to talk with one of our social workers about a concern or problem that you may have. We offer counseling services over the telephone and online. We also offer support groups. And many people find a support group a very helpful way to get support, and those are available on the telephone and online. And we have them for people with specific diseases, particular types of cancer, and also for caregivers, for people in general just wanting to get some support. So they're just can be very helpful to participate in. We also have lots of publications and fact sheets, and, of course, many of these workshops that we offer really throughout the year, and we have many of them planned. You have a schedule of all of our upcoming programs that we have. Most importantly, as we're about to conclude the program, I would not want anyone to feel that you are alone in coping with cancer. I want you to now feel that you're part of a community of support. You have Cancer Care and all the resources that are in your materials as well. And we're simply a phone call away, or if you prefer to email us, then an email away. But we're really very close to you in terms of your accessing help from us. I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect.